I'm Fawn Clark, and I... Sorry, what did you want me to say? I forgot. I'm writing it down here.
The Path to Authenticity is brought to you by GIA Miami. Founded by world-class mental health experts, GIA provides advanced care for difficult-to-treat conditions, including anxiety, medication-resistant depression, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. Using state-of-the-art methods, GIA can help people recover from conditions when more traditional approaches can't. Dr. Antonello Bonci has assembled an expert team serving international clientele in a modern and resplendent Miami setting. If you or someone you love is suffering from depression, anxiety, OCD, or other mental health concerns, call GIA at 833-713-0828. You can learn more about GIA by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting GIAMiami.com.
Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I am Fawn Clark, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity, episode 165 for March 8th, 2022. Well, I'm well into a move here. I'm moving back home to where I grew up a week from today. This is a conversation I had 6 or 8 weeks ago with a woman named Fawn Clark. And very warm, heartfelt sort of conversation, and a great woman. So I hope you enjoy it. Here we go. Fawn Clark.
Yeah, I'm in Ireland. Yeah, it's evening here. I'm in Cork, which is on the south of Ireland, the very southern part of Ireland.
Okay. Well, I have Irish lineage.
Oh, yeah?
Coleman is my paternal grandmother's name was... No, my maternal grandmother's name was Mary Coleman, and I think her mom and dad migrated to America, and I want to say County Mayo, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere there is a long family tree and what looks like parchment paper and, you know, very old somewhere. I'm not sure where it is. I got to get my hands on that. Lots of detail, though. It's been a long time since I looked at it, but it's a pleasure to have you. And so why don't you tell the listener what you do for a living?
So I work as a nutritional therapist, but I focus on working with people who struggle with their relationship with food, who find that they've sort of compulsively overeat for whatever reason. And so I help people to understand why they do it and to find freedom from it. And I suppose the way I work is, whilst I understand the importance of nutrition, I'm also incredibly aware of the spiritual and emotional reasons for turning to food for comfort. So I suppose I'm unusual in that sense, in that a lot of my time is spent helping people to understand what why they're looking, turning to food for comfort, and coming up with ways to help them to find comfort in other ways.
And if you had to choose one reason that you see most frequently why people turn to food for comfort, what would you say it is?
I would think it's just this underlying, that we're not conscious of it, but this underlying feeling of, I'm not okay, I'm not enough. And then that, from there, it, you know, people look, you know, I'm not skinny enough, or I'm not successful enough, or I'm not whatever enough. And that's really self-critical, that real critical self-talk leads to pain, which leads to then using food to ease that pain, which then leads to dieting, which then leads to more critical self-talk. So I think that underlying feeling of I'm not okay. And some people, for whatever reason, turn to food. You know, it's not everyone, but some people just turn to food for comfort. I suppose other people turn to drink or drugs or other things. So I'd say that is the, I know that's quite a big, you know, that's quite an umbrella term, I suppose, for it catches quite a lot, you know, but that's really the underlying issue, I think.
Well, it's probably the underlying issue for a lot of things, right? You know, I know.
But isn't that really the underlying issue for all that? Whenever we're seeking something outside ourselves to make us feel better, no matter what it is, that's at the root of the problem.
I think so. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's, there will never be enough, whether it's
absolutely
goals to attain, money to earn, love, sex, food, booze, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Television shows, internet access. Until we reconcile that within ourselves, it's always going to be something we're trying to get from outside of ourselves. To an expression that I used to hear a lot is to fix ourselves.
Yeah, totally. And really, like, when people come to me and say they've got a problem with their weight, I know deep down that giving them a food plan or helping them choose the right foods they think will solve the problem, or even in fact, people get hooked on this idea that if I get to the right weight, then I'll be happy. But unless they can work on that deeper dissatisfaction with themselves, A, the weight loss doesn't work, or they can't stick to the food plan, or they may get to their goal weight and they're still not happy, you know? Mm-hmm. So that underlying fundamental problem is what I try to get to, but it takes time, Tom, you know, and it takes, so I might see somebody and, you know, they might, you know, I mightn't hear for them for 10 months or a year or 2 years, and then they come back to me. So it really is a journey, you know, and I don't expect people when I work with them to get it straight away. It's like sowing a seed, and then it's up to the powers that be, you know, to, in their life, as to the time frame that it'll take for them to get to a place of becoming willing to look at those ideas that they're carrying around with them that are causing them to suffer so much. Well, I know from my experience, that was how it was for me as well. You know, it took time.
Well, I was going to ask, how did you come to do this sort of work?
Oh, because I've had my own journey with food, you know, and gosh, such pain I went through not knowing why I was eating the way I was eating. You know, at about the age of 16 or 15 or something like that, I saw a photo of myself and I thought, God, I think I look a bit too heavy. So I decided I was going to lose weight. And I started, I suppose I was, you know, anorexic type behaviors, you know, I really starved myself, and I felt delighted with myself that I was losing weight. But then I couldn't keep that up. And then I started, the binge eating started. And so then for the next 15 years, I was in the cycle of either being on a diet or binging. You know, it was one or the other. There was always that sense that I had to get something out of the food, there was never any peace with it. Totally lost track of any sense of when I was full or when I was hungry. And when I ate, if I wasn't dieting, when I ate, it was just out of control, you know? So, and eventually I, after years of, it was just so lonely. I think with food, I was really ashamed of it. So I always did it on my own, never told anybody, kept it a secret. It was, you know, it was like a big secret that I was keeping to myself, and always such effort put into trying to be normal when I was around other people, or trying to eat normally when I was around other people, and felt as a result so alone, so isolated, so depressed, and very, very suicidal towards the end. And in, and then in that time, I sort of got a degree in psychology. I did my nutrition training, and still sort of crazy, you know, at the end of all of that. And in the end, I drove myself to a treatment center and I checked myself in. And that was when I suppose I found a spiritual solution. And also, I suppose they exposed me to the 12 steps and 12 step fellowships. And that was a real turning point in my life. It was just coming at the whole problem from a different angle. And of course, I didn't, I thought, God, I thought it was crazy. I thought, you know, I'll just ignore the whole God part. I could see people were well, but I was so cynical and skeptical. But I think pain kept me there. And eventually my mind opened to this, to there being something greater than ourselves. And I became, I suppose, convinced and teachable, and did what was suggested. But it was slow. Slow, Tom, and you know, I could only be where I was at any particular time, and yeah, so that's been my journey. And so then I always thought that I'd never work with my nutrition. I thought I was too crazy around food, such a, you know, I never thought that I would be able to work professionally in this field. But after about 13 years of being free of the need to overeat, and I suppose working, you know, learning a lot about living spiritually and practicing it a day at a time and all the rest of it, eventually I became open to the idea that maybe I could offer people, I could be of service to people from my, you know, given my experience. So I set up as a nutritional therapist, and I love it. You know, I just, you know, just meeting people who struggle like I did and just giving them some hope is so rewarding. And yeah, so that's how I got into it.
So when you say you went to a treatment center, was that in Ireland?
Yeah, it was a local treatment center here, and they did, you know, they treated people for drugs, alcohol, gambling, and I think I was only one there with food. And it was you know, I thought, God, you know, what are they going to think of me, you know? Chocolate isn't a real addiction, you know, that's a, you know, they're going to laugh me out of it. But, you know, it was amazing. I was in there with heroin addicts who'd sort of come off the streets. And I always thought that they were really hardcore addicts. But when we shared our stories with each other, they were exactly the same. You know, that needing to escape, that needing to get into an oblivion because the pain of living was so unbearable. Now, I wouldn't have been able to put those words on it then, but, you know, the lengths that we went to were exactly the same. My drug of choice was just chocolate or sugar or food. This particular guy, his was heroin. And I remember him saying, Jesus, I think food is nearly worse. I'll never forget that, him saying, I think food would be nearly worse because it's everywhere and it's so socially acceptable and you have to eat. So yeah, that was interesting. It was really interesting. And I remember my parents not really understanding, because I was so good at keeping it a secret. They were like, what are you doing here? You don't have to stay here. You know, you can come home. Right. And I've never felt more at home anywhere in my life. These are my people. These are people who get me. And I suppose for the first time I was really honest with people, and you know, and it was okay to share my big secret.
What a powerful moment in life, isn't it?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. And it is funny, isn't it? And you hear the cliche, I'm so grateful for it, but it is so true. I am now so grateful for my issues with food because of the richness they've brought to my life. You know, I you know, the parts of myself that I've had to look at and let go of, and the, I suppose, the wisdom that it has forced me to see in the world, it is really a huge blessing. You know, the fact that we're having this conversation, the fact that I can talk to people at this level, you know, I if it wasn't for my experience with the food, I don't know if I would ever have been forced to, you know, look under the lid and see what was going on.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but I myself went to one of these treatment centers.
I was aware. I did hear that. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And had what I describe now as a problematic relationship with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And had that moment day one where I told everybody everything, or the group of people there. I spilled the beans on everything I was most ashamed of and was hiding about my behavior, and was scared to death to do that, but also knew that I needed to do it to survive, because I'd tried to not do it. And that didn't work. And it's funny, it's beautiful actually, how these things that we've done that we feel so ashamed of, that we're afraid of other people learning about us, what the huge lesson I got from that was, when I put myself out there in that way and I was entirely honest, I thought it would repel people, but it actually drew them in. And when I thought it would be met with scorn, it was met with love. It actually brings people closer to us when we're real with them about things. And I imagine that's probably not true with everyone. I mean, I'm sure there's some people who like couldn't tolerate that sort of vulnerability. But man, if you've been through something like that, it really touches your heart when someone else can articulate it, and it inspires them to do the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a healing thing.
It's so healing. And that's the paradox, isn't it? It's our greatest fear is actually the doorway to freedom.
Yeah.
You know, if we can go through that door and take that risk, the freedom on the other side. You know, we sort of, I felt like a prisoner in my own secrets and shame. And, you know, it was just so, it was such a relief to share the burden and be heard. And I think, you know, I spoke, you know, about that sort of critical self-talk, you know, that part of us that can't accept us as we are, you know. And I just think that acknowledging that, sharing of our secret was like the first, well, sharing my secret, I'll keep it about myself, was, it was like, you know, it was the beginning of self-acceptance and self-love, you know. And I nearly needed to be shown that by other people in order to love myself, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do know exactly what you mean.
So, and that was the beginning of, actually, I'm not, like, because I had this script, I wasn't aware of it and I couldn't have articulated it. But at the time, like, I'm fundamentally wrong. There is something wrong with me, you know, I'm not okay. And I cannot share that with other people because I would then be on my own and wrong. You know, the irony of it was that I was totally on my own. But, you know, that it's okay to struggle. It's okay to be different, and it's okay to, and then you realize, God, everyone struggles. Everyone looks for something outside themselves, maybe not to the degree that I did and not get to the levels that I did. But this feeling of being different then sort of melts away. It's so healing. You're totally right.
Yeah. And I had a few moments during that experience, interactions with people on the outside that really helped a lot. And one of those was I got a note from an aunt that said, you know, basically something that you just expressed. And the way she put it was, we all have our cross to bear. Mm-hmm. And what I got from that is there is nothing wrong with me. This is just what I have. This is just my cross to bear. Everybody has one. Mm-hmm. And I needed to hear that. And and then there were a couple people who, which, you know, coming, you know, from a big family with a bunch of drinkers where it was completely acceptable to just have a couple people. You know, the irony, I was thinking about this earlier. There's one family member who's still an active alcoholic, you know, was for 10 years before I stopped, and 25 years later is still going at it. And and yet, when my drinking escalated to the point where I got help, that was seen as the tragedy, right? that I got help. That was, oh my gosh, he's terrible. He had to get help. Well, yeah. But I got help. You know, I changed. And they're still at it, you know, so it's really interesting. But I had a couple people who just went out of their way to let me know how proud they were of me.
Yeah.
And one was, I did some sports writing before then at this little local newspaper from my hometown. And I got a note in the mail from the sports editor with press credentials saying, I'm proud of you. You always have a job here if you need one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And
it's man,
that just like, here I am 25 years later still talking about that because it was such an impactful moment to have someone believe in me that way at that moment in my life, you know?
Yeah, it's really good to hear that because those little tiny things, you know, sending a note to somebody at that stage of their recovery, it's good to hear that. Reminds me, and actually, you know, I'm just thinking, oh, you know, that is definitely something I could do if ever the opportunity arose, you know, that simple word of encouragement. I was the same. You know, there's a few people who just said, you know, who just got it. My family had no experience. You know, I didn't come from a family of drinkers or you know, they were sort of normal eaters. They were, and I remember, you know, after a few months of going to meetings, my father coming up to me and saying, are you going to spend the rest of your life going to those meetings? You know, and he couldn't get it, couldn't understand why I was sort of wasting all these opportunities. But there were people who, I had one uncle, he had stopped drinking, and he was incredibly supportive. So, yeah, in those early days, it's so fragile, isn't it? That you know, and there's so much self-doubt that those little words of encouragement and support can be so powerful.
Yeah, because, you know, we're at war with ourselves. We hate ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And we need that love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's we're in the dark and it's the light shining in on us, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And you're okay for having fessed up to your, you know, because I think, I don't know about in the States, but in Ireland, certainly, there's just a general feeling of you just don't talk about stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I think in America, you're much better at being open. Well,
yeah,
about
but
things.
We're still not great. We're still not great.
But there's definitely this sort of Catholic shame in Ireland where you just don't talk about anything, you know? Yeah. Just don't talk about it. And so I come from a big family, you know, so speaking out can be very uncomfortable for everyone else as well. You know, it's not, you know, suddenly it's like, oh God, she's, you know, she's exposing her weakness and that brings shame to everyone, you know? So it is a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to take that. It's a leap of faith, you know, but I think for me, and sounds like for you as well, suffering drove me to it. You know, in a way, it wasn't a choice in the end. I had to do it.
Well, yeah. I mean, a choice. Is it really ever a choice? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think I have a choice now. You know, I couldn't stop. You know, I could not stop. I had to be stopped.
And
I didn't want to go back there. And I think I experienced enough pain. You mentioned the 12 steps. One of the co-founders of AA, Bill Wilson, my favorite quote of his is, pain is the touchstone to all spiritual growth. And that's my experience.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, you know? Still to this day.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's just how much of it are we willing to tolerate, to endure?
Yes.
And people like us have high pain tolerances.
Totally. Absolute pain. It's really interesting you say that question of choice, because I don't think I had a choice back then either. I think I did need to be physically locked up, put away from food, or taken out of my environment with all those cues and memories. And it's like I needed to be I'm trying to think of, you know, it's like there was a voice in my head that was so strong that I completely and utterly identified with, that there was no way that I was ever going to get any distance from it on my own. I don't think, you know, or who knows, but certainly going to a treatment center where I was forced into consciousness. I even remember there was back then, I think it's different now, but they used to have chocolate biscuits in the cupboard. And of course, you know, all the others used to have chocolate biscuits with their coffee and their tea. And they used to talk to me from the cupboard. Oh my God, I was so aware of them being there. I really, really didn't want to go there. But, I had to, it was the only, trigger or temptation in the whole treatment center. And I remember they had to remove them from the canteen. No one was allowed to have chocolate biscuits when I was there. So I was that powerless over it. You know, I was, the obsession was so strong in my head, you know, and once I started, there was no stopping me. I did have to be removed. And I remember we were in over Christmas, and the treatment center closed for Christmas. So we had to go home for a week amid treatment.
Man.
Yeah. And so, oh gosh, I'll never forget. And I had driven my car there, so I had to drive home. And maybe for you, it would be like, you know, every shop that I, or store as you'd call it there, that I drove by, you know, it was like a trigger. It was like a cue to stop and go in, because that's just what I did. It'd be like you and a bar, you know, you see a bar and you just stop your car and you go in to get of course, you're just going in to get one.
Right.
But it never ends at one, you know. And my parents have a hotel, a country house hotel. And we were all going there for a big Christmas, and we were staying in this hotel with a sort of a restaurant kitchen and, you know, walk-in fridges and that sort of thing. And of course, you know, I just didn't get through the week. I could find myself like a zombie, you know, walking towards the big walk-in fridge in the sweets department. And I can't remember what I ate now, but I certainly ate more, way more than I needed to, and was way beyond the point of being full. But and then I was so glad to get back into the security and safety of the treatment center, away from myself. It's so funny. It's like protected from myself, because I just didn't feel safe being on my own for fear of what I would do to myself. Like, that is a horrendous state of mind to be in. It seems like so long ago now. I'd nearly forgotten it. But that feeling of, if you leave me on my own, I don't know what I'm going to do to myself, or what I will eat, or when I'll stop. So I did. I was that powerless as well. You know, I needed to be, I needed this sort of discipline and structure of a treatment center to snap me out, you know, to wake me up from the, it's just, it was just like being in a dream, you know, and more of a nightmare actually than a dream, of just going back again and again and again to look for comfort from food, and it was not working anymore.
Hmm. Yeah. I definitely can relate to that.
Mm.
I can't be alone without destroying myself. You know,
yeah.
If I had any time away from work at all, I just drank.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes to the point where I didn't get there, you know, I didn't get to work. Yeah. It's a terrifying experience.
It is actually terrifying. It's totally terrifying because you sort of feel, you know, when you can't trust yourself, where can you go? You know, there's nowhere that's safe.
Right.
I traveled a bit. I worked a bit in the States and I worked in Australia, and you know, the horror of realizing that I brought myself with me every time I went,
right.
You know, thinking it'll be different now, it'll be different. But that part of me that I couldn't face, that I couldn't be with, that I couldn't sit with, that it was so unbearably painful, was still there.
Hmm.
And I still needed to numb myself out with food. And it actually just feels now, looking back, like a different reality. It was a different reality. I didn't even know that this reality, of course I didn't know that this reality that I'm in now was possible. It was just so bleak and there was so little hope. It is a complete miracle that, I suppose I survived it or got to treatment center or found a way through. I feel that is proof in itself of something greater than myself, because on my own, I was an absolute disaster.
It's you know, I believe how I make sense of all this in my life is that this is how God drew me closer to Him. Because
mm-hmm.
that's ultimately, for me, that's the answer, right? That's mm-hmm. the, mm-hmm. that's, you know, the hole we're trying to fill with the food or the booze or the drugs or the sex or the gambling or whatever it is. It's a God-shaped hole.
Mm-hmm.
And I thank God that I knew that. I don't know that I knew that exactly, but I did have an understanding that described it was that I had to get right with God.
Mm.
That was the answer, and it was something I didn't want to do. I didn't want to be one of those quote unquote holy people,
mm-hmm.
holy roller, whatever. And I just didn't think that was cool at all. And I had to go through enough pain to where that didn't matter anymore. I just didn't want to die anymore.
Yeah.
And for me, what it ended up happening is I did a third step before I knew what it was, which is, you know, I got on my knees and said, okay, you can have me. I'll do whatever you want. Just don't make me live like this anymore.
Mm.
And I don't remember ever experiencing the obsession after that, maybe once.
Wow.
Maybe one more time within a few days. But it was lifted, you know?
Wow. Yeah.
Just like they tell you that if you do that, it will be. It is, you know, it happens. But we have to, you know, The AA big book talks about abandon yourself to God as you understand God.
Mm.
Abandon yourself. Mm. And, you know, the to me, what's beautiful about that is in doing that, we find ourselves.
That is the paradox, isn't it?
It is. It's so true. It's so true.
That is the paradox.
We think it's bondage, but it's freedom.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That surrender is, and I don't know that surrender, like it's a God, that's the God thing. That's the thing that you cannot manifest from any sort of academic place or place of reason. It has to be a sort of I think that surrender comes from a different place, because you can't think I want to surrender and then do it. You know, it's not logical.
Right.
Mm.
It's emotional. I mean, it's a heart. It's a function of the heart. For sure.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. 100%. And I actually, funny, when I came out of the treatment center, I was surrendered to a degree, you know, and I think there's layers, isn't there? There's layers of the onion. And listen, I'm still surrendering every day. Right. I'm surrendering. But those big surrenders, you know, I got out of the treatment center, and then they politely suggested that I go to another treatment center, a secondary treatment center, which I went to for 6 months. And then they said, I think you need to go to a third, sort of halfway house, which I went to for a year. So I was sort of in that sort of treatment environment for quite a long time and needed every minute of it. And even still, I came out of that and was hanging on to a lot of old ideas, you know, just so they were so entrenched and so automatic and so they just felt like part of me. So I ended up returning to the food again and again and again. You know, it took so long to, I think food is slightly different in that you can't get that physical distance from it. So in a way, you need to be much more present, because you have to engage with it three times a day or four times a day, however many meals you have in a day. So the room for resentment and fear is far less, because you're so close to it all the time. And so I did end up, you know, relapsing again and again. And actually, it was way, way worse, because I knew that there was another way, and I wasn't so, you know, it was horrendous, actually. It was hell. And the pain of it was probably on some levels the same, but I now knew I was falling from a higher place, a place of more freedom. I was so much more conscious. And Jesus, you know, going back into a meeting and just saying, I've done it again, and the despair and that fear of, will I ever get this? You know, I'm one of those hopeless cases. And you know, and so after 3 years, there was an unusual chain of events. I was actually at my brother's wedding in New Zealand, of all places, and I was in the food again. And I went to a meeting. It was actually, there's no OA meeting. So my husband actually is an AA, and he said to me, he brought me to an AA meeting, because he said, you need a meeting. I don't care what sort of meeting it is, but you need to be at a meeting. And they said to me at that meeting, just pray. You know, like you said, just pray. And I was thinking, what the hell is that going to do for me? I'm way beyond needing prayers. I need more. Anyway, I prayed. And about 2 days later, people were put in my life. And from that day on, I didn't need to use food in a compulsive way. You know, I suppose that was 14 years ago now. So it is the mystery of life, isn't it? It's the when that intention is there, I think ways open up. And I don't understand it. You know, it seems like make believe.
Yeah,
my experience has been that, like, when I'm ready, the teacher appears. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, it really is true. But you reminded me of a saying that I know to be true, and that's that A head full of AA and a belly full of booze don't mix.
Once you know.
And you know, being a treatment professional, you know, having worked with a lot of families, I've often got the question from parents or spouses who are putting their family member or their loved one in treatment. Is this going to work? You know, is this going to work? Is this going to be over? And one of the things I've learned to say, which I could say proudly because I've worked for good treatment providers, I could say this may not be the end, but I promise it will be the beginning of the end. Mm-hmm. Because they're going to know. Now they're going to know. They're going to see it clearly. And if they go back to it, they will be miserable.
Yeah, I know. I must be horrendous for family members watching on, you know, so powerless over whatever about being in it. But, you know, I suppose that's a whole other thing, isn't it? Letting go of the family members' recovery.
Yeah. I have found myself, you know, I've been a counselor for a long time, and I, you know, went through a divorce about 8 years ago, 9 years ago now. And having done all that in sobriety, then worked on all those issues, those layers of the onion. And then suddenly these men started appearing in my life who were having significant problems in their relationships, many of them in long-term recovery, but they're like having another emotional bottom. And I've, you know, been able to have an opportunity to work with guys who are going through that with their wives, and, you know, it's devastating, especially when you are sober and you see it so clearly and there's nothing you can do about it.
Oh, I can only imagine the powerlessness over it. My husband is, he's over 20 years sober now, but even realizing that I'm powerless over his behaviors and he's sober, that's a whole other learning and a whole other opportunity for growth and a whole other school, I think, marriage. And wonderful if we're willing to learn the lessons that it'll teach us.
Well, they bring us closer to God. They do if we let them, you know.
If we let them. It's like anything though, Tom. It's like children, you know. Gosh, the challenges that I've, you know, I can see myself getting angry because my 7-year-old isn't behaving like a 20-year-old, you know, like crazy stuff, but only because I have a program, I'm aware that, hang on, I am, you know, why am I getting angry now? You know, and the lessons, the teachings that I've got from my family. In fact, in the last 2 years with COVID and we've been at home so much, you know, I have grown so much because I've had to look at all these relationship issues, and it's been like a whole other huge awakening, you know, and again, it's just like the food is like a doorway into love, God, being at one with ourselves, knowing who we are, you know, if we allow them. But my God, the pain and the hanging on to old ideas, the terror of letting go, the terror of letting go and being taken advantage of, you know, that for me was a huge one especially with my husband. So that's been a massive journey that we've been on together. So yeah, it never ends. The journey never, it just gets richer and richer and richer. And there were times where
it does get better, doesn't it? It just gets better.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know, it just gets so much better as I can have a little bit of a sense of humor about myself and just, you know, it just gets better on every level. And I always find Christmas is a great marker because I've noticed that every Christmas has gotten better and better and better and better as I've been less consumed with myself and been able to just enjoy the company the whatever, the shenanigans, whatever's going on, you know? And I think that, you know, the reason it gets better is because I'm just less obsessed with myself. Mm. And it's a God thing. You know, it's not, no, true, no, I can't take any credit for it. I think it's, you know, once you're on this journey, things are taken from you.
Mm. So if someone wants to work with you, how do they, what does that look like and how can they learn more about you?
So, lots of different people contact me, you know, on, you know, obviously, people's relationship with food, there's a continuum, you know, and some people who are just a little bit upset about their weight, they want to lose a bit of weight, they maybe eat a little bit more than they should at meals, will contact me and I'll, you know, I'm very happy to work with them, right up to people who are like me and, you know, really running from something and using food majorly as a source of comfort in their lives, you know, not able to sit with themselves at all. So so I help people with understanding food, understanding nutrition, understanding how food affects us, how sugar affects us, and how our brain is wired to look for sugar, and even our culture today around food is so it's just not what we were designed to live with, you know. Right. It's so hard on our system to filter out all the stimulus everywhere. I suppose it's no different to technology but food is just everywhere, and it's processed in a way that makes it so palatable that it's so addictive. So I suppose I educate people about food, about food choices, and give them some structure if they need it. Everyone's a little bit different in how much structure they need. Because so with food, obviously, you still need to eat. So I help them with a food plan. And so that gives them some sort of anchor or something to, okay, this is what I need to eat in the day. And then we work on the reasons why I'm tempted not to eat what's on my food plan, you know. So they wake up every morning and go, okay, this is what my intention is to do today. And then we look at why they went awry or what went wrong or what thinking led them off track. So I suppose, and then people might come to me just for two sessions, or people might come to me for they might see me for every week for months. It depends. And I do see a lot of people in 12-step fellowships who are already working on a spiritual program, but just want to know what is a healthy food plan, what that might look like, and how much to eat. And maybe they've got health issues and they want to know what to eat to deal with their health issues. So that's really how I work with people. And I'm on Instagram, or there's my website, which is fawnclark.com.
And I'll link to that in the show notes so people can find you. You're welcome. So, Fawn, if you had it to do over again, if there was a time in your life when the younger Fawn needed a word of advice or support when she needed it the most, I can assume when that might have been, but maybe not. Mm-hmm. When would that have been, and what would you go back and say to her?
Oh, I think it would have been when I was about 15, when I was so self-conscious and insecure. And I would have said, "You're okay. You're okay." I feel that I would just give her so much attention, love, a listen, and let her know that she's okay, because that's really how I fundamentally felt like I wasn't okay at that age.
Hmm. Well, that's kind of circling back to what we talked about in the beginning, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
Our relationship with ourself is so important.
That's where it begins. Oh, that's where it begins and ends. And anything that doesn't, I can give people food plans and all the rest of it, but until that relationship is looked at and until we become friends with ourselves and until we become, and until we can tolerate our own company, it would be impossible to stay on a food plan or, to lose weight or whatever it is that you're wanting to do, because it's so unbearable. I remember, when I think back about what I used to say to myself, no wonder I turned to food. You're not this, you're not good enough, you're not clever enough, you're not funny enough, you're not, interesting enough. Like I was just not enough of anything. So no wonder I turned to food, So yeah. That is it, that is it. And letting go of the fear of accepting that we're enough right now. I think that's the thing, the fear of accepting that if I accept myself as I am right now, I'm not going to be alone. It's okay, and that's the big leap to take, isn't it?
One of many.
Mm-hmm.
One of many.
Yeah. Yes.
But they all, like even this doing this podcast for me was a huge leap to use my voice in this way, to transmit it out into the world and to just, speak and be who I am. And it never comes back. It never comes back.
I know. You're putting it out into the ether.
It felt so scary.
Yeah.
But I also knew with what I wanted to do, I had to show up and be real or else it was going to be a big waste of time. And,
I can completely identify with that because even me putting my story up on Instagram, it's one thing sharing at a meeting where everything's, anonymous and, it doesn't go beyond the meeting. But sharing my story on Instagram, my goodness, I think the last year or two where I've just been putting my story out there, telling people about it, I meet, my neighbors know my history with food. The people at the school gate know my history with food. And just being that authentic out in the world and, not having the defense of being somebody or having it all together or has been real learning for me. But I don't know about you, but I found it incredibly healing. I found it incredibly empowering.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's
I'm
freedom.
Going to that place of fear. Oh, it's freedom. Totally. Because this is who I am. No matter, I'm not hiding anything. This is back to what we said, and this is the next level, I think, for me, of being authentic and open and not hiding. If I can be myself at this level, that's freedom,
Yeah. Well, this has been great. I appreciate you doing this and I hope you've enjoyed it much as I have.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And I mentioned Clubhouse to you. You'll have to check. There you go. Another episode in the books. Thanks for listening. You can learn more about the show and this episode's guest at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with someone. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every little bit helps. I want to thank the band Punk Rock Opera, whose music you hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. If you're so inclined, check out the Patreon community. As soon as I do these interviews, I upload them to Patreon, where the content is only available to patrons and for just a couple bucks a month. I usually post audio content there, exclusive audio content, probably 8 times a month, if not more. And as these new episodes are released as soon as they're done, they're available to patrons. So sometimes that might be 2 weeks before an episode is released or even longer. Usually it's a few days. Anyway, if you want to support the show, that's a great way to do it. So thanks again for investing your time. It's a big deal to me. Thank you for supporting me and supporting the show. I hope you keep coming back. Be nice.
That's our story. I hope you enjoyed the punk rock opera. And we have one last piece of music for you. It goes like this.
Okay, go.
Thank you, and good night.